You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
And I'm a conservative, but don't forget, this is called the Republican Party. It's not called the Conservative Party. You know, there are conservative parties. This is called the Republican Party.
And parts of the Republican Party are now being called a few other things besides by the man supposed to be leading it. We'll look into today's installment of Donald Trump versus absolutely everybody and everything. Also ahead, we'll examine the extremely short-lived partnership between Slovakia's state broadcaster and one of Vladimir Putin's favourite news agencies. We'll find out why one term isn't enough for Paraguay's present president. We'll meet the editor of the New York Times magazine.
Well, of course, this is a great time for all different kinds of media, whether you're working at a magazine, a newspaper, a television news station. There is just so much interest in the news right now.
We'll look at what appears to be the conclusive disgrace of Brazil's once powerful Speaker of Congress, and we'll find out why Swedes are worried that Finns drink too much. That's all coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Malaysia has released to the custody of North Korea the body of Kim Jong-nam, half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who was murdered last month in Kuala Lumpur Airport by means of a nerve agent. Under the same agreement, North Korean citizens in Malaysia will be permitted to leave, including, it is believed, three people suspected of involvement in the killing. Possibly not coincidentally, Pyongyang will permit nine Malaysian citizens who had been barred from leaving North Korea to go home. Turkey claims to have ended Operation Euphrates Shield, its seven-month-long campaign in northern Syria, though doubts persist vis-à-vis what Turkey actually means by this. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim would not be drawn on whether or not Turkish troops would actually leave Syria and did reserve the right to launch further military action in future. The announcement came as U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived in Ankara for talks. France has joined the chorus of European Union countries, insisting that they will not negotiate the terms of any future relationship with the United Kingdom before the terms of the UK's departure from the EU are settled. British Prime Minister Theresa May had called for simultaneous talks in the quaint belief that the moment you decide to leave a club is the opportune moment to start telling them how to run it. And French artist Abraham Poncheval, who recently made the and finally sections of news bulletins the world over by entombing himself inside a boulder for a week, has moved on to a new project, incubating 10 chicken eggs with his own body heat in a glass case inside the Palais de Tokyo Museum in Paris. Mr. Poncheval believes that it will take between 21 and 26 days to hatch the eggs, which will be cradled in a container beneath his chair. It's better than sitting around doing nothing. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. In his short but eventful tenure as President of the United States, the list of people with whom Donald Trump has taken issue, umbrage or offence runs to a hefty percentage of the population of planet Earth. It is probably not all that surprising, therefore, that he now appears to have started on his own party. The latest addition to President Trump's epic enemies list is the House Freedom Caucus, a Tea Party-ish GOP tendency that helped scupper Trump's healthcare plan. Well, I'm joined, first of all, by Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York bureau chief. Ed, briefly, who are the Freedom Caucus?
They're sort of, I wouldn't say secretive, but we, you know, that the full amount of members, the names of all of them isn't published, but they're essentially ultra-conservative members of the House of Representatives who opposed the healthcare bill based on the fact that they did not believe that it was conservative enough. Donald Trump seems to have kind of lurched from courting them to attacking them. You know, we know that they had a meeting with the White House prior to the healthcare bill in the hope that they could kind of salvage it. That didn't happen. There was another meeting on Wednesday, a closed-door meeting with the caucus. But despite the fact that was just a few days ago, or less than a couple of days ago, Donald Trump has now decided to go on the offensive, which, of course, as you were saying before, we've seen him do many, many times.
Is the Freedom Party likely to be untowardly bothered by this, or indeed to respond to it? Presumably they priced in this sort of response when they decided to thwart him.
The Freedom Caucus, yeah. I mean, obviously, we'll have to see whether Donald Trump backtracks a bit. I mean, he's basically suggesting that he will kind of table candidates in the midterm elections in 2018 against members of that caucus if they don't kind of get in line. He's saying they need to be fought along with the Democrats. He'll backtrack, we have to wait and see. Paul Ryan, who's kind of an apologizer in chief for Donald Trump at the moment, basically suggesting that the tweets that Donald Trump's made are kind of a way of him venting his frustration at the failure of the health care bill, nothing more. I think the Freedom Caucus, one might argue, is happy with the publicity they've been getting a lot at the moment, and they feel that they've been left out of decision making in many instances, and they feel that their kind of extreme or very conservative views haven't been represented by the House of Representatives. To use the word representatives a couple of times. So in a way, it's good publicity for them because it gets their cause out there more. And people like Mark Sanford, who's from South Carolina, a member of that caucus, has been speaking out, saying today that Trump threatened him directly or sent one of his henchmen to threaten him if he decided to vote against the healthcare bill, which, of course, he did as a member of that caucus.
And just finally, Ed, do we think this row has got legs, or does everybody assume that by this time tomorrow, Trump will have gone off against, I don't know, Zambia or bassoonists or something, and that'll be the story of tomorrow?
Well, I think as we've seen during this short presidency that feels like it's been years already, there's always something, in the news agenda at the moment. The big story that's kind of been continuing to break today is over the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee and the information its chair received, and whether he briefed Trump on information he shouldn't have done. I mean, that... To put it briefly, I mean, there's always a new story with this presidency, isn't there? We lurch from one thing to the other. So although obviously it's a big story today, there's so much drama in this presidency that doesn't seem to be going away that I'm sure we'll be talking about one or several other things in just a matter of hours, Andrew.
Ed Stocker, thanks for joining us. Joining me now with more on this is Ryan Williams, Senior Vice President at FP1 Strategies and a former spokesman for the 2012 presidential campaign of Mitt Romney. Ryan, first of all, the eternal question where Trump's outbursts are concerned, is there, as Ed was saying, various people have been suggesting he is just venting, or is there an actual discernible strategy here?
I think it's venting. I think if we've learned anything from following Trump over the course of his campaign and this administration is that he uses Twitter as an outlet to vent. That being said, I do think he has a long-term grudge with the Freedom Caucus, especially if they continue to block his initiatives that might range from infrastructure spending to tax reform. He's not happy with them. He thinks that they're to blame for this, and they are. And I think he'll keep the fight up as long as they continue to stand on their principles and block his avenues of progress for legislation.
Is it possible that he's beginning to perceive the Republican Party itself as a threat and is therefore trying to, I guess, splinter it into more manageable factions?
I think he's trying to bully the Freedom Caucus into getting on board with the plan that that he and the House leadership had put together. That being said, look, Donald Trump is not a longtime Republican. He's someone who was a Democrat years ago, became a Republican recently. He's not really tied to the party ideology. He's tied to his kind of own nationalist ideology. So I think he's frustrated with the Freedom Caucus. I think he does want to get them on board, and I think he thinks he tried to meet them halfway with giving them some concessions on the health care bill, which were unsuccessful, and I think now he's trying to turn to maybe intimidation and bullying, but I don't know if that's going to work. I don't think the Freedom Caucus members care all that much.
How damaged, though, was his standing, not just obviously with the Freedom Caucus, I think that ship's probably sailed, but with the Republican Party as a whole by the failure of the healthcare bill?
In terms of the party, I think he's probably fine. I think that, you know, he's going to keep working at it. His comments on Twitter since then have been, look, don't worry about it. We're going to do this. Give him more time. I think the party largely is staying with him. He still has approval ratings with Republicans in the 80s and 90s. It's hard to shake members of your own party. I mean, I saw a poll yesterday where 74% of Republicans think that Trump Tower was wiretapped despite having any kind of evidence. So just kind of shows you the dedication that the party faithful generally have to a president of their party at this stage in the term.
But where is the tension as far as the Republican Party is concerned between his high standing among Republican voters and among his own supporters and his historically low standing at this stage of a presidency among the voting public as a whole?
I think that there are a lot in the party hierarchy that are nervous about that, the implications that it may have if his numbers maintain at this level for the midterms in 2018. But look, the White House has been dismissing it as fake polls and, you know, saying that the polling companies didn't get the right snapshot in 2016 when he won, so don't believe it. So the White House, I think, isn't concerned about it for whatever reason. They're certainly not saying that publicly. I do think, though, that some in the operative class and at the head of the party structure are nervous about the implication on 2018 Republican Senate campaigns and what he will, you know, if his numbers stay this low, will that be an anchor on the party?
So when you look at, you know, I guess not just today's outbursts, but the pattern of the last couple of months, and as Ed pointed out, it does already seem like so very much longer than that. Are you seeing a president and a party basically working together, or are you seeing, and it was a familiar narrative before Trump took office, this idea that the Republican Party would somehow seek to constrain or restrict or even, I guess, train him?
Well, look, the party is fractured, and I don't blame Trump for this. The party was fractured before he became president. There has been, you know, this is why Speaker Boehner, Speaker Ryan's predecessor, resigned, because the House has been in two factions, the Freedom Caucus and the everybody else, basically, for years now, and it resulted in the Speaker having to resign, and it hampers the power of the Speaker, because Republicans have a 19-seat majority in the House. The Freedom Caucus is bigger than that, so they can, if they vote against something in a block or even in a majority, it can tank legislation. That really weakens the hand of the Speaker. It weakens the hand of the President. The President and Speaker Ryan, despite the fact they did not get along very well during the campaign, have really kind of mended fences and have worked together. The problem is that they don't have enough votes in the Congress to override the will of the breakaway Freedom Caucus, and that's something that has predated Trump being in office. It was that way when Obama was president and Boehner was Speaker. The House has not really been united ever since we took the House back as a party in 2010.
And just finally then, 2 months and some change in, as you look at President Trump as a Republican, are you getting the sense that he is actually learning anything about the realities of governing as opposed to the realities of running a business where people just tell him to do, or just do rather what he tells them?
I think he is meeting reality now that despite the fact that he won and that he's president, he can't control everybody. This isn't like brokering a real estate deal where it's about dollars and cents. Many of these members of the House Freedom Caucus don't operate on, you know, persuasion. They're rigid ideologues. They have a very specific ideology that they believe they went to Congress to uphold. And, you know, cutting a deal with them, they don't really respond to that. They're absolutists. They want everything. So I think it's probably, he probably had this idea that he could go in and he could change their minds and work the charm on him as he's done in business, and that doesn't really work in every case with these ideologues. However, there are a number of other items on his agenda that he'll get to press, in addition to health care, tax reform, infrastructure spending, which he may sell some Democrats on that, so we'll see how it progresses, but I think reality caught up with him on this one, and hopefully he's learning that the sausage-making of lawmaking is different than business deals.
Ryan Williams from FP1 Strategies, former advisor to Mitt Romney. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're with The Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Now, this week's news that Slovakia's state news agency TASR had forged a partnership with the Russian outlet Sputnik, arched many an eyebrow among those who might have imagined that Eastern Europeans of all people would have learned to regard Russian news from the other end of a very long barge pole. Rather hearteningly, sufficient uproar was prompted that TASR have today abandoned the tie-up. But what were they thinking in the first place, and where next for Russia's forays onto the information battlefield? Well, I'm joined now by Mark Armand, historian of Russia at Oxford University. Mark, welcome to the show again. Sputnik is saying today that Slovakia's news agency TASR has abandoned this tie-up due to what they're calling official pressure. Does that seem plausible?
Well, there's been a mixture of pressures, as public opinion pressures inside Slovakia, political pressures from parties own, no doubt. I'm sure Slovakia's partners in the EU and NATO would be suspicious of this. I suppose the broader question is, as you were hinting in your introduction, are there countries in Eastern Europe that perhaps don't have the inveterate Russophobia that we might associate? We may think, say, for instance, Poland is a society where the great majority of people, in a sense, imbibe fear of Russia with their mother's milk, partly obviously because of the communist period and the occupation by the Red Army after the Second World War, but also, if you like, Imperial Russia's occupation. But of course, there are some countries which were never occupied by Imperial Russia, for instance, so they didn't have a very long history of being subordinate to Moscow, and may have, as it were, visceral local rivalries. And I think the problem with Slovakia, for instance, is that there's more of a tension with their Hungarian neighbour, ironically run by a government that is also not particularly on the Euro mainline in terms of being sceptical about Putin. But nonetheless, Budapest and Bratislava have national differences, nationalist differences.
Is it possible to understand why anybody at TASR would have thought this was a good idea? It does seem like one of those ones straight out of the, you know, the what could possibly go wrong file.
Well, you would have thought that given the likelihood that other partners wouldn't be happy, they would have thought of that. I think one question, of course, is simply an economic question. One big problem for many smaller countries in the post-communist world and around the world is that you're really asking places the equivalent, if you like, of Kent or Maine to have a media service that is comparable to a large country. And so it's actually quite expensive for a news agency not only to provide information about its own small country, but also to provide all the kind of internal information and so on that it wants to show that it's playing in the big league. And so one of the things that Sputnik is able to do, of course, is to offer quite a lot of content relatively cheaply. You could say, if we were Marxists, that the dialectical contradiction of the success of the market economy is that Western agencies make you pay the market price, and if somebody offers you access more cheaply, you may be tempted by it. So there may be, as it were, an economic rationale that you could get feed of pictures and information from around the world that the Slovaks themselves couldn't afford to generate directly.
When we look at Sputnik itself, does it have any case whatsoever for being thought of as anything other than a straightforward, naked propaganda outlet?
Well, I think that, in a sense, it obviously has an editorial line that is favourable to the Russian government and certainly reluctant to criticise it. But on the other hand, I think if we talk about propaganda and effectiveness, one of the things that I think we perhaps are exaggerating the need to be afraid of is that it's not exactly like the old Soviet Union and we don't live in it, or like Slovakia was before 1989. It's not as though it's the only source of information so that you can compare and contrast. And so, for instance, sometimes Sputnik will produce more quickly some information, say, from Syria, for instance, where it might have people who in the government areas which other Western agencies don't have. But I think in the case of the Slovaks, of course, coming back to their particular issues, as I say, if you think in terms of culture, Slovaks historically were more likely to be pro-Russian. And so, for instance, in 100 years ago, 1917, Czechs and Slovaks often had deserted in the First World War to fight in the Tsar's armies against their German-speaking Hungarian rulers, and then played a big role in the revolutionary Civil War period and so on. And so it may be that in Bratislava it didn't seem so odd for these kinds of cultural reasons, that if, for instance, you had said this in Warsaw or Bucharest, you probably, it wouldn't have got off the ground, let alone been signed, only to be torn up.
There is, of course, a fair amount of fear, loathing and general paranoia abroad about the influence and ambitions of Russia's news agencies, especially following the presidential election in the United States. But to what extent, as far as we can tell, are Sputnik and other outlets like RT thought of by the Kremlin as actual arms of foreign policy?
Well, I think they play a role in, as they have their slogan, question more, and you could say that they raise questions, even if not necessarily the answers that people will give to them would be the ones that perhaps would be chosen. But I think if we think about it, it's highly unlikely, in my own view, that many Americans saw these programs, and so how many people influenced? And for instance, a lot of the RT coverage of America was from a rather left-wing, almost Bernie Sanders perspective, attacking Wall Street, attacking the power of what they would deride as banksters and so on. So you might say that they might have helped to boost Bernie Sanders' voters, but how many of the people in Wisconsin and Michigan who rejected Hillary Clinton and voted for Trump, giving him, you know, the majority in those vital states, even if not in the overall vote count, had ever heard of Russia Today or Sputnik? I think probably one would be inclined to doubt. There's always the problem, isn't it, that we are interested in all these issues, and therefore we focus on them. But whether the broader public in a very diverse media landscape, as you have in so many countries, particularly in the United States and Europe, would be affected. What is perhaps more an issue is when you have societies where you don't have much alternative information at all, and then if somebody from the outside is able to set up a news agency or a media channel that can reach into that society and, as it were, open it up, it may be that people feel they're seeing the world in a new way, but they are then only getting one point of view. But I wonder how far, in a world where people are connected by so many devices, so many different channels, you know, how far a single foreign voice can influence you that heavily, even if that's what the purpose is behind it.
Mark Armand, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
This is The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, when Alfredo Stroessner, the interminably serving dictator of Paraguay, was removed by a military coup in 1989, Paraguay's people might have hoped that they'd seen the last of presidents for life. Since then, indeed, give or take reservations about the domination of the right-wing Colorado Party, Paraguay has been a reasonably orderly democracy, its heads of state limited by the 1992 constitution to 1 5-year term. However, the present incumbent Horacio Cartes seems to fancy a longer run at it and is seeking to amend the constitution accordingly. Well, joining me with more on this is Declan McGarvey, a correspondent covering South America. First of all, I guess, well, two questions in one. Why is President Cartes saying he wants an extension, and why does he actually want one?
Well, the official rhetoric coming from Horacio Cartes is that he needs more than 1 5-year term in order to push through the deep-reaching pro-business and pro-market reforms that his party feels are necessary for Paraguay. His opposition in Parliament is saying that Horacio Cartes is seeking to lead Paraguay once again down the line of authoritarian rule and possibly towards dictatorship, as you said in your intro.
The opposition to this has been quite spirited. There have been demonstrations. There's been a bit of a punch-up in the parliament. Who are the people objecting to it?
Well, there is both objection coming from within the national parliament in Asunción, the capital of Paraguay, which was witness to those extraordinary scenes that you just talked about there, which was this week as the ruling party, the ruling Colorado Party, which the president leads, attempted to push through some constitutional amendments that further down the line may allow him to amend the constitution in order to stand for re-election and possibly unlimited re-election, which is giving rise to these fears of future authoritarian rule or a return to dictatorship. Now, those extraordinary scenes saw this punch-up in Parliament, and while that punch-up was happening, a representative of the ruling party declared himself to be in an impromptu speech, the Senate leader, and held an impromptu vote on the floor to those who were listening to him, and in a show of hands, passed the resolutions that the ruling party had put forward. Now, as this was happening on the outside of the parliament, on the streets and plazas of Asuncion, there were troops, elite Paraguayan troops placed there, tanks on the streets as well, in order to maintain the calm. And those had been placed there, or ordered to be placed there, by the incumbent president, Horacio Cartes, again giving rise to these fears of a return to the type of rule put in place by Stroessner. Now, it's mostly coming from the opposition. It's also within Parliament, but that opposition is also coming on a popular level. And this is very important to point out, that polls are showing that 80% of ordinary Paraguayans object to this constitution amendment and want to see the constitution maintained as it is without that possibility of re-election. So in a way, this becomes a real litmus test of Paraguay's very fragile democracy. You have a very strong executive in the form of Horacio Cartes. He is testing the power of Parliament to be that kind of check on or balance on his power. And Parliament at the moment, it seems, is not playing its role and not representing the voice of the general population.
So you talk about there about the president amending the constitution. What's the process by which he can do that? Doesn't he need to call a referendum?
Well, this goes back to August last year, in which Horacio Cartes attempted to push through with the lawmakers in Parliament a constitutional amendment that would overturn that constitutional limit on one term of 5 years in office, allow him to stand for a second term next year when his first term ends, and possibly open the door to further terms after that in terms of unlimited elections. Now, that tabling of that amendment was narrowly defeated within the National Parliament and put temporarily to bed, but has now been resurfaced by Cartes, who is again seeking to do this. But this time, it seems that he's trying to do it from a very kind of backdoor method. What happened this week in Parliament was that his political party put forward kind of introductory amendments that would allow changes in parliamentary protocol, which is they are passed, which they were passed in those chaotic and commotional scenes this week on Tuesday. Even when they are passed, they would then allow this further amendment to be pushed through. And it seems that in this occasion, Cartes is confident of getting a majority support in Parliament to see that happening. There have been accusations of bribery, which have been denied and haven't been proven. And there are also some opposition lawmakers who are in fact supporting this, particularly from the former president, Fernando Lugones, who ruled Paraguay between 2008 and 2012 when he was removed. He was impeached and removed from office. He is also seeking a return, another bid for the presidency next year. And in order to do so, he also needs this constitutional ruling to be overturned and amended. So both elements of opposition and ruling power want to see this done, but at the same time, the majority of ordinary Paraguayans want the constitution to remain in place.
So what happens next, then, if there is this tension between what the president wants and what you say the majority of ordinary Paraguayans want? How does this get resolved?
Well, first, I mean, there needs to be a return to calm on the streets. Protest and social unrest is rising in Asuncion, the capital of Paraguay, and other cities in the country as well. So, you know, there needs to be an allaying of the type of fears that so many ordinary Paraguayans have of a return to the days of Stroessner. And a lot of what Cartes seems to be doing is echoing those days of Stroessner, these ideas of a state of siege. Putting tanks on the streets, putting military in the plazas on the streets of Asuncion is exactly what Stroessner did during his 35 years in power, attempting to modify the constitution in order to stand for re-election once again. Stroessner did that continuously for 35 years in power. This is raising the fear and the sense of dread of ordinary Paraguayans. Secondly, it would seem to be necessary that their elected representatives should therefore represent their interests within Parliament. If 80% of Paraguayans are saying they do not want this, then surely it is the job of the Congress, in Asunción, to represent their interests and to provide that check and balance on power on the executive. This really is a test of what are fragile democratic institutions and balances of power within Paraguay. A country within like a continent that's known as the continent of coups, Paraguay itself is known as the country of coups. And, you know, ordinary Paraguayans are fearing a return to that type of authoritarian rule once again.
Declan McGarvey, thanks for joining us. We'll have more from South America later in the show as a big Brazilian political beast is imprisoned. You're listening to The Daily. And it's time now for this week's installment of The Weeklies, our weekly survey of exactly those periodicals. You might guess that the first photograph ever printed in the New York Times was on the front page. You would be wrong. The Times' first photograph actually appeared inside the New York Times magazine, which was first published in 1896. It was positioned as a serious countervoice to the piles of fluffy fare offered by other weekend publishers of the early 20th century, and it's often been credited with saving the Times from ruin. The magazine's editor, Jake Silverstein, spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about what's in the upcoming issue.
There is a very interesting story that the readers may find of particular interest at the moment about the British writer and activist Majid Nawaz, who's some of your listeners are familiar with him. He's a founder of an organization called the Quilliam Foundation that seeks to eradicate Islamic extremism in the world. And what's notable about Nawaz is that he himself is a former extremist, having spent a little bit of time in prison for his relationship with the Islamic Revolutionary Organization in the early 2000s. And so he's got a kind of an interesting perspective as somebody who has felt the lure of radical extremism and is now in a position of trying to explain why others might feel that way and what can be done to counteract it. That's quite an interesting piece.
How is it to be the editor of the magazine in such a politically charged moment in the U.S.?
Well, of course, this is a great time for all different kinds of media, whether you're working at a magazine, a newspaper, a television news station. There is just so much interest in the news right now. The New York Times has seen its subscriptions grow by leaps and bounds, and whatever your measurement you're taking is, it's just clear that the reading public is engaged in a pretty profound way. And I think that makes all of us feel like the work that we're doing is important and vital, and we feel a sense of pressure to get things right and to kind of rise to the occasion. And that's always a good feeling, really. I mean, you want to be doing important work. The interesting quality for us at the New York Times Magazine that's a little different perhaps from other magazines is, or at least other magazines in the United States, is that there aren't too many magazines that are like ours, that are sort of serious general interest titles that are supplements of a newspaper. So most of the magazines that we consider our peers are magazines that are standalone newsstand magazines, such as The New Yorker or The Atlantic. And unlike those magazines, we're connected to a newsroom that's covering the events in Washington and around the world every single day. And that doesn't mean that we don't consider it our job to also cover those things, but we sort of do it in balance with a Washington bureau that is second to none.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How do you find the balance? Because, you know, as a follower of your magazine, you do make some quite interesting features, you know, about politics in the U.S. or even abroad as well, with some kind of lighter tones as well. Like, for example, I love the issue about the 25 songs that tell us where music is going. I think it's always such a joy as well.
I mean, to me, it's a great joy to be the editor of a general interest magazine, because versatility, flexibility, having something to say on a range of topics. I mean, that's just great fun to be in that position and to get to work on so many different kinds of stories and different subjects and, different kinds of writers and photographers and illustrators and artists as well. It's a great joy, and we feel very lucky to have such a wide range of movement that we get to undertake every week. And we definitely think about how the magazine will relate to the overall reading experience of the New York Times. So, you know, when we publish an issue like the music issue, the one you just mentioned, 25 songs that show us where music is going, we know that that's going to be a bit of a break for the reader who's opening up the Sunday paper and reading through a lot of pretty serious news on the in the front section, probably about Trump or, you know, world events, and that they're going to get to the magazine and it's going to be a little break. And sometimes that's great. Sometimes that's a perfect role for us to play. Of course, that doesn't mean that we, you know, this coming weekend we have a major story about Donald Trump on the cover and his legislative path forward after the failure of the healthcare law last week. So we, you know, by no means do we consider our role to be providing a kind of respite from the serious news and the rest of the paper. We like to mix it up. And when we do the longer stories, the question that we're always asking, when we do the more serious stories, which is, I think, the majority of what we do, honestly, we are always trying to figure out what distinguishes a story in the magazine about Donald Trump from a story in the newspaper about Donald Trump, of which there are, of course, many.
I did look at the latest cover, and again, it's impressive as usual, you know, the design. I was thinking about it. Do you think you can allow yourself to be a little bit more even experimental with the covers because of the fact that you're, you know, a supplement of a newspaper? So, you know, people don't grab it just because of the cover. So you allow yourself certain liberties that you wouldn't on a normal weekly without a newspaper.
100% agree with what you just said. And I actually think it's one of the opportunities for this magazine. Again, I mean, I recognize that in Europe, there are more magazines that are serious, that are supplements of newspapers, but there aren't that many in the United States. And so for us, in our environment, the fact that we are not on the newsstand, that we come with the newspaper, that's a huge opportunity. And one of the things we've really tried to do over the last few years is take that opportunity and use it. And the way we try to use it, or the way we sort of interpret what the opportunity is that, you know, we have a huge amount of freedom, and that should be an invitation for us to be experimental on the cover, to be very design forward in the way we think, to challenge people, to do stuff that's beautiful. Of course, we want readers to hold on to our covers and put them on the news, on the coffee table, and enjoy them as works of art, but also to do stuff that will be provocative and change people's perceptions about what a magazine cover can do. And certainly we are free of the obligation that we would have if we were on the newsstand of having to, in a straightforward way, sell the issue. And that's just a huge gift for us.
Jake, I'm curious about something. Another very successful publication from the New York Times is, of course, T Magazine. What's your relationship with the team? Because it seems to me that, you know, it's also, you know, coming out in the newsstands more frequently than in the past. That's at least my perception.
No, it's about the same as it has been. Although, if that's your perception, that's probably a good sign, right? It means it, you know, it's top of mind for you. We don't have that much of a formal relationship. I mean, our staffs are seated close to each other in the building, and we are all quite friendly, and we share some writers, and we certainly share some information, and occasionally we'll kind of put our shoulders to the wheel together to help on something. But for the most part, the magazines operate pretty independent of each other.
And finally, Jake, which other magazines do you look for, you know, perhaps inspiration, or just when, you know, when you want to relax on a Sunday afternoon, which magazine do you pick it up to read?
Well, like a lot of people here in the States, I read The New Yorker religiously. It's one of the great magazines in the country, and we're often covering some of the same stuff, so sometimes I'm reading it, you know, as a competitor, looking to see what they've got that we don't. The Atlantic has always been very interesting. New York Magazine, a perennial favorite. Harper's Magazine, others as well, but those are probably in the top of the kind of things I regularly go to. I don't read German, so I can't really read it, but I always look at Zeit Magazine for the design, which I find quite interesting.
That was Jake Silverstein, editor of the New York Times Magazine, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to The Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, an ancient wisdom holds that prior to embarking on any mission of vengeance, one should dig two graves. Eduardo Cunha, the former Speaker of Brazil's Chamber of Deputies and orchestrator of last year's impeachment and defenestration of President Dilma Rousseff, will have 15 years and 4 months to ponder this. Such was the sentence imposed today after Cunha was convicted of corruption and money laundering. Well, joining me now from Rio de Janeiro is Monocle 24's correspondent Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, does this seem like a huge deal now, or is everybody in Brazil somewhat scandal weary at this point?
This is definitely a big deal because, as you mentioned, Eduardo Cunha really was the leader of the impeachment against Dilma Rousseff, which started back in October 2015 and dragged out until the end of August 2016. He's also dubbed as the Frank Underwood of Brazil, that he's such a manipulator and mastermind. So this is really a big win for the people because for the longest time, he was one of the least popular politicians in the country, despite the fact that he was 3 terms at the helm for being a federal deputy, and he was a speaker of the lower house. But he really was manipulative and controlling and was really deep into corruption, which is a big reason why Brazil's crumbling right now. So this is a bit of sweet justice for the people.
Remind us, if you would, briefly, because this scandal, which, as you point out, has been going on for years and involves a cast of thousands, is incredibly complicated. But what has he actually been convicted of? Because 15 years and change is a long stretch.
Yeah, exactly. And this actually isn't the only process that he's been processed for. But let's just go to why he's convicted for this one. So basically, it was an oil field contract, which was in the African country of Benin. And basically, he was found accepting a $1.5 million bribe in a foreign bank account in Switzerland in order to give this contract to a particular company. And this was a Petrobras company, which is a state-run oil company. So he was basically found to have manipulated that. And so he's being convicted and charged on 3 counts, which is passive corruption, evasion, and money laundering.
Now, does he, as I understand it, have some recourse to appeal, does he not? But what does it tell us that while that process goes underway, he's been told he will be imprisoned?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about this is despite the fact that he's been behind bars since October, that still hasn't stopped him from threatening authorities and witnesses in this case. And of course, he is going to appeal it. In fact, his defense has denied that he's had any bank accounts abroad at all, despite the fact that it has been proven with the help of Swiss authorities that he does have Swiss bank accounts and that they were used to accept these bribes. So he's still denying that, and that is what his defense will play on. So obviously it's a tough pill for him to swallow, but this is a very nasty man, and I'm sure that he'll try to find some way to get out of it, especially using the slow Brazilian justice system to his advantage.
The scandal which has consumed him is known by the catch-all phrase car wash, and as you pointed out, he's far from the only person involved with it. Aside from anything else, there's still ex-President Lula, there's literally dozens of senators and governors on the hook. How much enthusiasm does there still seem to be among press, public, judicial establishment for hunting everybody down?
Well, there still is a fair amount of enthusiasm for that. And this is actually a big win for the people because Eduardo Cunha is the first major politician to get such a stiff sentence like this since the end of the dictatorship in 1985. So for the longest time, a lot of it was, okay, let's just give these politicians a slap on the wrist. Even the president has been found to be involved in some scandals and corruption cases of his own. In fact, that's why he can't run for president in 2018 because he's been found on corruption cases, which bars him from running. So this is a slight victory for the people in the sense that it seems like things are going in the right direction for Brazil, but Brazil still certainly has a long way to go. I believe the last time that I spoke to you guys on air, we were talking about how Brazilian politicians who are in office were looking to pass a bill that they could get amnesty against their crimes while they're in office. Of course, this doesn't apply to Eduardo Cunha because he's been out of office since October, but you know, a lot of these politicians that are still in power, including the president itself, they do have a sort of amnesty against some serious convictions.
Sheena Rossiter in Rio, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. It's time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again in that endeavour by John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other postings. John, we start with the South China Morning Post, which I am rustling here to create some ambience. This is weird. We have a diplomat accused of taking quite substantial sums in dollars, cash, gifts, etc. from Chinese intelligence agents.
That's right. Candace Claiborne, 60-year-old, a State Department employee, has worked for the State Department since 1999, it turns out, recently arrested and charged with passing secrets illegally to the Chinese, and specifically of having contacts with Chinese intelligence agents that she failed to report, which is a breach of State Department rules and regulations. Little details have started to emerge. Thousands of dollars changing hands. We don't really know what she gave them in return. It may have been quite innocuous stuff. Some people say that most of it was actually lifted off the internet. And it turns out that a lot of the money was passed not direct to her, but to a man half her age with whom she had been living in various parts of China, where she had been posted at various stages, including his fashion course, holidays, and various other goodies for him. We don't know the identity of this person, but it's entirely possible, I'd have thought, that he is also Chinese, which would make this one of the oldest tricks in the intelligence book, a two-pronged entrapment.
John, you have, of course, worked as a diplomat in the field representing your government. If while you are acquitting that duty, a emissary of the host government comes up to you and says, here is a large sack of cash, is there ever any good reason for not running as far as you can very, very quickly?
The kind of circumstances where you do anything but that are so obscure as to be meaningless. No, you simply smile politely, push the sack back, and walk out of the door.
Extraordinary story, of which I suspect we have not heard the last. President Xi, of course, due to meet Donald Trump imminently.
That's right. People are saying this is too small a story to spoil the ambiance, but who knows what Donald Trump might say?
Well, indeed. Sticking with the South China Morning Post, this is the, curious story of a Chinese man shot dead by French police earlier this week. There's been two nights now of violent protest over his killing. Do we actually have any idea what happened in what order as yet?
No, we have two very different accounts. The French police say that they were called to his apartment in a largely Chinese peopled part of Paris, where he attacked an officer with a knife and another officer had to fire in self-defense. The family say this is rubbish. Yes, he was holding a knife, but he was trimming a fish at the time, they say, with no ill intent towards the police, so that effectively his killing was a murder. The Chinese quarter of Paris has erupted in violence, as you say, two nights worth, and significantly and unusually, the Chinese government has felt obliged to comment. We now actually have the wording of the comment. It's very carefully put together, calling on the French government to guarantee the security of the Chinese residents in France, which the French government mostly does anyway, and to treat the feelings of the Chinese people in a rational manner, which means anything or nothing depending. It looks to me like the kind of statement the Chinese government puts out when it's feeling political heat at home. And the Chinese blogosphere is full of very hostile comments against France for this killing. There's a big nationalist upsurge behind this.
Okay, well, let's look now at the Japan Times, which has a... this is a story of an absolutely extraordinary corporate meltdown.
Yes, and how. Not many years ago, 2006, Toshiba, with huge fanfare, bought Westinghouse, the American electricity generating company, known in particular for its prowess in nuclear generation. Toshiba hoped that this would be a doorway into what they thought would be a glowing nuclear future. Actually, that was a badly phrased, wasn't it?
But you know, I was reflecting on my earlier use of meltdown, even as you spoke.
Oh, well, there we are. We're in this together. But things just have not worked out, to put it politely. Westinghouse had to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy about 48 hours ago. Toshiba has announced that it has guaranteed, Toshiba corporately has announced that it has guaranteed about $9.8 billion worth of Westinghouse debts, which, of course, still has to be written off. And the hole that this has left in Toshiba's balance sheet is not the kind that you can paper over easily. At a rather stormy shareholder meeting today,
I would think.
Yes, Toshiba secured a majority vote in favour of selling off its highly profitable and much-prized chip-making business. So it's selling the crown jewels, effectively, to cover the hole in its finances. Various investors have made various rather rude comments about the competence of Toshiba's top management. Toshiba, they're saying, is now a laughing stock. And one memorable quote, an investor saying, "How is it that what we were told would be a pillar of the Toshiba empire actually turned out to be a hole?"
We should move along finally to the Indian Express is reporting this. It's a story from Indonesia, which I'm pleased to see because it's, well, I'm not pleased to see it because it's bad news for the chap at the centre of it. But it's usually my homeland which features in horror stories about snakes around the world. And I will say for Australia's snakes, so they can get a bit bitey. They don't actually eat people whole, which is what appears to have happened here.
Well, that's right. An unfortunate farmer called Akbar went out to harvest his crop wearing a pair of Wellington boots, a pair of shorts and a harvesting tool, and was not seen again. A little later, villagers noticed a 7-metre python, so a big beastie, wriggling around in a ditch, looking rather uncomfortable, as if it might, for example, have bad indigestion, and put two and two together. And earlier today, sure enough, they caught this python, slit it open, to find Akbar very dead but still intact inside him. There's a rather sad video of Akbar coming out of the python, boots first.
On that somber note, John Everard, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. And finally tonight, we raise a toast to our friends in Finland, even if their neighbours in Sweden won't, or at least probably feel like they shouldn't. Because Sweden's state alcohol retailer, Systembolaget, and try saying that after you've had a few, has written to the European Commission, no less, outlining their fears for Finns' health, should Finland's parliament pass a law liberalising the sale of alcohol, of which Finns are already Scandinavia's most enthusiastic consumers. Well, earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards sat down for a glass of still water with our own extremely sober resident Finn, Markus Hippi.
So as you may know, each Nordic country has its own state-owned alcohol retail monopoly, and Finland is indeed trying to make that role less dominant. So it's been suggested that in the future, breweries, for example, could sell their products outside to customers. Also, other kind of production facilities could sell their products. So, for example, you may have someone making wine somewhere. They could sell that to customers directly without having the national alcohol licensed retail system involved over there. Now, in Sweden, so in Finland, this system is called Alko. In Sweden...
Catchy.
Exactly. In Sweden, the equivalent is called Systembolaget. And now this Swedish alcohol store monopoly has got worried about what's happening in Finland. And they have sent a letter to the European Commission saying that Finland should not change its legislation because Finns drink too much already, and this is not going to do anything about that. It's only going to make things worse. And obviously the question is, what does Sweden have to say about this? Why would they be worried about what's happening in the neighboring country? Well, the issue is that all these Nordic countries have been in the same boat pretty much ideologically when it comes to trying to control how their citizens consume alcohol and where they buy the alcohol from. And now we see Finland go into a different direction. So they want to diminish the role of the state-owned alcohol store monopoly. So that's what other countries are worried about as well.
Now, Marcus, it's interesting because a lot of people are saying, well, OK, Sweden is suggesting that this is basically on public health grounds and that where we see a loosening of regulation, we see an increase in alcohol consumed. But I gather that some people are unhappy on that on two levels. One, they claim Finland actually doesn't drink that much compared to the rest of the EU. And secondly, they say there's something else at foot here. This isn't just about health. The Swedish monopoly, maybe they've got concerns of their own.
Exactly. That's what I said already. I think they're worried about, you know, their own status in Sweden. They're afraid that someone will get wrong ideas if they start following the Finnish example. There's also the thing about Finnish alcohol consumption. I guess no one is really denying that making alcohol more easily available would not increase the consumption. But at the same time, there's a lot of speculation about the forbidden fruit effect in Finland, when it's quite hard to get booze sometimes. Do you feel like drinking a bit more once you get it? And also,
and just personally, Marcus, we know that's probably also true with you.
And I was just going to mention that you have seen me behave at Christmas parties with free alcohol around. Does it look that bad?
Yes, it's reprehensible. It's appalling. I'm disgusted. I'm shocked.
No.
Each Christmas, frankly, every time the Christmas party rolls around.
Frankly, if you look at the EU statistics, Finns actually consume less than the EU average, about 0.2 litres of pure alcohol, less than your average.
You're drinking
European.
Just pure alcohol?
No, but like less than, you know what I mean. Anyway, I think why there's this vast stereotype of Finnish people consuming a lot of alcohol is about the way we consume it. So in Finland, you don't really do much on weekday evenings. You don't go out with your friends for a drink. Instead, you save all that for the weekend.
It's and then a binge Friday, drinking culture.
And then it's Friday or Saturday evening and you consume all the alcohol of the week at once, which may not look great.
Is that why you have so many sick days on Mondays, Marcus?
No, it's for other reasons. I don't take that many Mondays off.
I'm only joking. What about the relationship between, if we take a step back, the relationship between Sweden and Finland? Is there sometimes a perception in your motherland that, I don't know, maybe the neighbours stick their oar in a bit and get involved where they shouldn't?
Well, we're always joking about that. Finns always think that Swedes think they know things better than others, and Swedes always seem to think that Finns are just walking around drunk carrying a knife somewhere. That's the stereotype.
That's what I think.
I just wanted to give you my view on what is happening in Finland, by the way, about, you know, changing laws. I think it's quite tough sometimes over there. You can't actually buy anything stronger than 4.7% after 6, 7, 8 o'clock on Saturday evening. These shops are closed on Sundays.
I mean, you were drinking alcohol at that strength when you were 5 or 6 years old.
Not quite. But it's actually quite hard. So if you want to, say, prepare a nice dinner for your friends on a Sunday and then you don't realise to go to Alko shop to buy your wine by Saturday 7 p.m, you can't get it from anywhere because you can't buy it from bars either. You can't take it home, even though that has been suggested as well. So if things go as I actually do hope they will go, you can actually in the future go to a shop, buy your wine in the evening from a bar, take it home, or you can go to your local brewery somewhere and buy products home instead of having to go to Alko to buy anything that's stronger than a 4.7%.
I'll drink to that, Marcus.
Likewise. Cheers.
Monocle's Tom Edwards and Marcus Hippie bringing to a close today's edition of the Monocle Daily, which was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Jolene Goffin and Anthea Longo, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. In tribute to our friends in Finland, we are pouring ourselves another old-fashioned, and we'll leave you with this track by Julie London. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.
Since I went on the wagon, I'm certain drink is a major crime. For when you lay off the liquor, you feel so much slicker. Well, that is most of the time. But there are